First would like to welcome all of you to find a seat and a cup of coffee, and I'd like to ask our distinguished panelists to take their seats on the dais, if they will. The morning panelists, yes. Are you one of them, Tina? So, let me check. Who's... Okay. So this would include Tina, Ricky Fortune, myself,
and Sharon.
And Sharon Berlin. Okay, good. And Ricky, good morning. And now it's my very great pleasure to welcome all of you to our 11th Centennial Symposium, From the Task-Centered Approach to Evidence-Based and Integrative Practice. First, I'd like to thank a great many people for all the work that's been done in preparation for this symposium. In particular, I'd like to thank the organizers, Tina Zibnicki and Stan McCracken, as well as all of our distinguished panelists. I'd like to thank as well all of you for coming and for joining us. Many of you came from very great distances, to enjoy the panel and to celebrate, some of you, your anniversaries, not only of SSA, but your anniversaries and graduation from SSA and from the university. So it's been a really remarkable centennial year for SSA. We have had, in addition to these academic symposia, 3 Harper Lectures, a conference on gangs and urban violence, and multiple alumni events across the country. Last night, we had an amazing gala where we honored distinguished civic leaders, Frank Clark, as well as Ron Huberman. We awarded Frank the first Julius Rosenwald Award for Distinguished Civic Leadership. And the room was filled with individuals who've been so supportive of SSA over these 100 years, including former President Hannah Gray and current President Robert Zimmer. And it was a good time, I believe, was had by all. I'm going to, for the last time, provide you with a quote from William Rainey Harper, the first president of the university, because it's so important to how we think about SSA and to what we're celebrating in terms of SSA's 100th anniversary. Some of you, if you've attended all of these events, as I have, and I can tell you, it's been better than going back to graduate school for a degree to attend these symposia. It's really just been a remarkable learning experience. But at each of the symposia, I have reminded our audience of the vision, really, of William Rainey Harper, first president of the University of Chicago, who defined SSA as an institution committed both to rigorous standards of research and inquiry and to open engagement in American society. Harper once said, "Democracy has scarcely begun to understand itself. It's for the university as a center of thought to maintain and advance the ideas and ideals so essential for the success of democracy." Harper understood that the dynamic exchange between the university and the campus was critical to the development of knowledge in medicine, sociology, human development, economics, and in particular to the School of Social Service Administration. This combined focus on rigorous inquiry and civic engagement was really catalytic in the development of this school, the Chicago School of Social Service Administration. One of the great privileges and pleasures of this centennial year is has been the occasion to return to the archives, return to some of our historical documents to uncover yet again the remarkable work that was done early in the school's history and has continued until today. The Chicago School of Social Service Administration was really the result of the pioneering efforts of our founding mothers, Edith and Grace Abbott and Sophie Nisbet Breckinridge, who, along with other important luminaries in the school's history, are displayed in honor before you. They worked, the faculty still do work in the policy areas of public health, immigration, child welfare, and labor, and helped, in Harper's words, democracy to understand itself. So as you know, Edith Abbott was the first female dean of SSA and any graduate school in the United States, and Sophie Nisba Breckenridge was the first female graduate from the University of Chicago Law School. The collective work of these women and others helped to professionalize and secularize the profession of social work. They very much laid the foundation for a mode of inquiry and practice that emphasizes rigorous social science research to illuminate and ameliorate serious social problems and to formulate effective public policy. And today, SSA faculty, researchers, students, and alumni have carried forward this very important tradition. From the 1940s through the 70s, SSA has remained at the forefront of social work practice education and innovation by applying the scientific method and systematic analysis to the process of determining the best course of action. These pioneers established task-centered, evidence-based, and cognitive integrative practices, and this symposium is representative of how these practices are being advanced and developed. In addition to examinations by our guest presenters Ricky Fortune, Sharon Berlin, Denise Kane, Elsie Pinkston, Ron Rooney, and Harold Briggs, we are going to have an understanding of how these techniques are being used and developed today. And Julie Littell's presentation will examine the science of research synthesis and methods used to detect and correct biases in the identification and analysis. Now I'd like to take a few moments to reflect on some of our important colleagues in this research trajectory of the school. Laura Epstein and William Reed, in particular, developed the task-centered treatment, the first theory and research-based social work model. Their work and Elsie Pinkston's became the forerunners of evidence-based practice, which, as we will define it today, is the decision-making process which integrates best available evidence, clinical expertise, and the understanding of the client in context. Today, it's considered just good practice. Before I end, I'd like to share a story that Tina likes to tell about Laura. So it turns out that Laura had hoped to become a clinical psychologist, but her path was unexpectedly thwarted when a prominent male faculty member in the University of Chicago's psychology department dissuaded her from applying. He told her psychology wasn't a field for women, and while there may be a few exceptions, Laura was not one of them. He then advised her to go across the street and enroll in the School of Social Service Administration. Well, Laura, crushed, bought a giant 1-pound Hershey candy bar, ate the whole thing, and cried for several hours in a bathroom stall, as she reported to Tina. A few months later, she received a letter from the university saying she'd been awarded a scholarship to SSA. But after discovering that a social worker, quote, was someone who went into poor neighborhoods and talked to unpleasant people to give them relief. Can't you hear Laura say that? She knew she didn't want any part of that and told Edith Abbott, she had a lot of chutzpah, thank you for the scholarship, but I don't want to go into social work. I want to go into psychology. Well, Miss Abbott made it crystal clear, as she always did, that as far as the University of Chicago was concerned, the money would pay for Laura's tuition was for coming to SSA, so if Laura chose not to attend SSA, that she wouldn't get an education. So Laura enrolled. And much to her surprise, discovered that there were a few strong activist women who had done something to, who did have something to teach her, and that she had a great deal to learn. Fortunately for SSA, a great career was born, and Laura never ate another Hershey candy bar again. Sam McCracken and I were also sharing stories this week about Bill Reed. For those of you who did not have the pleasure of knowing him, he was both the kindest soul and was ever the absent-minded professor. Bill was a pipe smoker, and Stan's favorite story is Bill's tendency to forget that he would place his lit pipe in all sorts of odd places. Most notably, in his briefcase. filled to overflowing with student term papers and other manuscripts. So as Stan reports, these papers always turned out very well baked. And I have a favorite related memory of Bill, who was probably the most prolific scholar in social work, even today. And he would always come to faculty meetings with his infamous bulging briefcase, sit down and pull out a manuscript he was working on, and simply, as the drama of the faculty meeting unfolded, he would very methodically proceed to crank out yet another brilliant and important publication. So I will simply finish by thanking Tina and Stan for their leadership in creating this event. I'm really looking forward to it, and it's my very great pleasure now to introduce the David and Mary Winton Green Professor, Tina Zipnicki.
Good, I forgot how to use this. So, thank you, Jean, and welcome everybody to SSA on this beautiful morning and this wonderful alumni weekend. Stan McCracken and Harold Briggs actually also contributed to organizing this event. Harold is a professor at Portland State University in Oregon. We plan a symposium for Alumni Weekend to reflect on some specific contributions of the school to the development and evolution of evidence-based practice. In particular, we're focusing on real-world implementation issues and strategies that are aimed at overcoming them. Our goal today is to provide a forum for practitioners and agency leaders to engage in dialogue about implementing evidence-based practice in agency programs, given current constraints and support systems, including resource issues, in light of pressures by funders to apply empirically supported interventions. The first half of the day will comprise three papers representing various ways evidence has been and is being used to inform practice. After lunch, we'll have two panels present experiences from the field. Then a final paper takes a critical look at the use of research syntheses to inform practice and program development. We're going to start the day with a historical perspective. Stan, Harold, and I were students during the Task-Centered Services Project. Our first speaker, Ricky Fortune, was a doctoral student at the time and played an important role in the initial testing of the approach in the late 1970s. This model, a clear prototype of what we now call evidence-based practice, was informed by the problem-solving approach and behaviorism. The originators of the approach, Reed and Epstein, unlikely partners if you knew them, came together to embark in a multi-year effort funded by the federal government to design, implement, and test the approach. They trained graduate students in the 1970s and into the early 1980s, placing students into a range of field settings that provided the initial tests of the model. In subsequent years, graduates disseminated the approach broadly as they moved into social work positions of leadership, both nationally and internationally. It continues to evolve and wield influence on practice, as evidenced by its incorporation into basic social work texts as an exemplar of sound practice. Reed and Epstein, along with Elsie Pinkston, who brought a rigorous behavioral perspective to bear in her teaching in partnership with Reed in the second year program called Problem-Oriented Practice, encouraged students to draw on empirical findings to inform their practice and to collect data from their cases to inform ongoing case decision-making. Ed Mullen was also on the faculty at the time, and it was here that he began to develop and teach personal models of practice, also based on the principles that are central to evidence-based practice today. It might be helpful if we start with a common definition and understanding of evidence-based practice, because we often behave as though we all understand it similarly. Now I have to figure out how to use this. There we go. So first of all, I have some students here from our doctoral program who will find this to be a familiar slide. While we're not going to go into great depth about what evidence-based practice is, I think it's really useful to begin. You don't have a handout on this, actually, at this point, but if you want one, we can make one later. I think that there's often a lot of confusion about whether evidence-based practice is a product, a noun, or a verb, a process. And it's been used both ways, and sometimes it's actually not very clear in the literature which definition is being applied. So as a noun, evidence-based practice is distinct from the process by a group of interventions referred to evidence-based practices or evidence-based interventions or sometimes empirically supported treatments. While evidence-based practice is an overarching approach to social work practice, evidence-based interventions are specific treatment modalities for which there are empirical evidence to support their effectiveness and utility in practice. So that's the actual product. Then we have evidence-based practice as a verb or a process. Evidence-based practice as a process, it blends current best evidence, client preferences whenever possible, and clinical expertise, resulting in services that are both individualized and empirically sound. So very often when we talk about evidence-based practice as a process, we talk about drawing from the evidence base, the scientific literature that informs practice, but also we talk about engaging as practitioners in a very specific set of steps that constitutes collecting data on our cases and taking a look at the data, evaluating the effectiveness of our approaches, and then modifying them when necessary. This is kind of hard to see. I don't know if you can see it very well, but here we have the model. This is probably one of the most current models of evidence-based practice as a process that shows you that not only do we draw evidence from the literature, from research studies in the literature, the empirical support that's available through our scientific knowledge base, but it combines practitioner expertise as well as client preferences and expectations within a context of the client's circumstances, clinical conditions, and all of that within even the larger context of organizational processes and structures. So there's a very strong recognition, particularly at this point in time, that we just don't take evidence-based practices from the literature and apply them without thinking very carefully about the context in which they're being applied and taking into account, most importantly, the client's preferences and values as well. What this suggests then is that evidence-based practice is an approach that makes very strong use of collaboration. There's sometimes a myth out there, I think, that we take what is known in the literature, in the scientific literature on social work practice, and just apply it without consideration of all these factors. These are the steps as outlined by Leonard Gibbs, and they represent sort of the key features, the key pieces of the process of evidence-based practice, which include, first of all, being motivated to apply an evidence-based approach, both on the part of the client as well as the practitioner, taking the information needs and formulating questions, well-formulated, specific, concrete questions that will enable you to search the literature in a very systematic kind of way to draw upon what we know is most useful for practice. Tracking down the evidence. We have these days computer technology and web search engines that really help us get to knowledge in a very efficient kind of way. Appraising the knowledge for its validity and utility in any particular case or program, and integrating that evidence with these other factors that I just mentioned a few minutes ago to implement and then evaluate the effectiveness of our work. The final step is teaching others to do the same. And we do that through courses, through professional development programs. We do that in agencies through ongoing workshops. So the speakers today all have a connection to these efforts at one time or another in SSA's recent history. Some of us started as task-centered students of Reed and Epstein. That would include Ricky Fortune, Ron Rooney, Denise Kane, Stan McCracken, Harold Briggs, and myself. Some of today's speakers have a connection by being members of SSA faculty linked to empirically based practice and more recent evolution into contemporary forms of practice, These include Elsie Pinkston, Jean Marsh, and Sharon Berlin. Jennifer Bellamy, one of our other speakers later on today, is one of our new and talented SSA faculty appointments. She got her start at Columbia University under the mentorship of Ed Mullen and continues a line of scholarship related to the university agency partnerships. And then Julia Littell, another graduate of SSA, is currently a leading scholar on the role of systematic reviews for informing evidence-based practice. Stan Harold and I designed a program for today that we hope will not rehash old controversies, but instead will promote useful dialogue about current issues and implementation and how to address them. We very much intend the symposium to promote discussion with you about your experiences and have designated time after each presentation for questions and discussion to take place. At this point, I'm pleased to introduce our colleague from State University of New York at Albany, Ricky Fortune. Ricky teaches research and social work practice at both the undergraduate and graduate levels. Her research is in the areas of task-centered practice, termination of social work treatment, aging, and field education. She has numerous publications to her credit, including the book Task-Centered Practice with Families and Groups, and she co-authored with William Reed Social Work Research. She is past editor of the Journal of Social Work Education and the Journal Social Work Research, and she is also past president of the premier scientific association of our profession, Society for Social Work and Research. Please join me in welcoming Ricky back to SSA to present the contributions of William Reed to empirical practice in social work.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Tina, and thank you all for being here. I'm going to broaden my topic a little bit. I'm going to talk about the development of task-centered practice. So I'm going to talk about the contributions of both Laura Epstein and William Reed and many of the other people who are actually in this room. Now, I'm talking about history, but the thing is that I have to find my presentation. I'm going to be talking about the history, but in fact, for many of you in this room, it's not history because you've lived through it and you're living it. So I'm going to ask you, I'm sure I'm going to make some mistakes and say things that were not your experience. So if we do that, please let me know, but don't let me know until after I've finished. Thanks. this is Bill and Laura. Bill is at I think it says 1954 or something like that, NASW conference, back when we had large-scale sponsors as social workers, you'll notice. That's their first text. I thought when I was starting this that one of the things that I did not know and didn't understand was why did we suddenly have an empirical practice movement? Where did all of this come from? It wasn't just Reed and Epstein. It was a whole range of people catalyzed and exploding in social work research. So where did it come from? So I tried to look at some of the context that empirical practice, and I'm using Reed's term when I say that, but we are talking about evidence-based practice, the context in which this came from. First of all, in the 60s, and 50s, as most of you know, social casework was very psychodynamic by our terms now, and it was dominating in social work, and there was very little evidence for or against it, and there were a number of scholars who were seriously questioning some of the empirical or some of the theoretical underlying pieces of it, but they didn't really have any kind of evidence or any way of looking at practice as anything different. At Columbia University, which at this point was the center of this kind of questioning of psychodynamic approaches, Florence Hollis and James Beery, who was doing a project on clinical judgment, were really training people in in-depth in psychodynamic approaches, but also in research approaches to look at what some of these things. Some of the people involved are listed there if you can read it. Can you read it or shall I just read it out? You can see it. Okay, good. For example, there were dissertations supported by Beery's NIMH grant that were looking at clinical judgment by Harvey Plotnick, Henry Miller, Scott Breyer, Ben Orcutt, Tony Tripodi. So a large number of people whose names you should recognize who were pretty much classmates. They weren't all in the same cohort, but they all knew each other and were fertilizing each other's questioning and their ideas at Columbia. They all moved, as unfortunately doctoral students have to do, once they graduate, but they clustered in a couple of places. UCLA had Breyer and Miller. Michigan had Stewart, Tripodi, and Epstein, and they joined Ed Thomas, who was already there, working in behavioral areas. SSA had two sort of subclusters. Arthur Schwartz came to SSA and then hired Elsie Pinkston. So that behavioral cluster was going on at SSA. And then Bill Reed came and worked with Laura Epstein, who was already here, and also a little bit later, Ed Mullen came to SSA as well. So there was this group of people who, and I tried originally to do a like an echogram that showed all the relationships. These various people moved around and influenced each other tremendously. For example, at Michigan, the group of Stewart Tripodi, Irwin Epstein, and Ed Thomas influenced Sheldon Rose, who then went to Madison, who influenced Bill Butterfield, Eileen Gambrell, and Clay Shorkey. So this group of people were training their own students, they're training their doctoral students, and then they were moving around and cross-fertilizing. So there was a lot of excitement at that point and a lot of different approaches. Now, the piece I don't know is why Reed and Epstein decided to develop their own practice model instead of following the behavioral model. They certainly incorporated a lot of behavioral ideas, and also, as I'll show you a little bit later on, they got very interested in family systems and started incorporating family things. But whereas the others were working on behavioral models, they decided to do their own model that would be different from social work. What happened to, this is the catalyst for the task-centered model. They were, Reed went on leave from SSA and went to the Community Service Society of New York, which in those days, large agencies also often had large research units that did. We just don't see this today anymore, but this was part of their research unit. Was a large four-year research project looking at different types of casework treatment for families that had family problems, marital problems, and children's and problems with the children. And now I'm going to go into a research lesson. As I said, I do teach research, but they decided that they were going to look at the different types of services that were currently available, try to compare them and see which were more effective. The primary division at that point, people remember this, the difference between ego-modifying and ego-supportive casework. In ego-modifying, you, and this was the, I call it the cat's meow. You had to be an experienced, prestigious therapist in order to do ego-modifying casework. It was a very heavy use of insight-oriented verbal techniques, so self-examination so the client can function better through increased understanding of the dynamics and origins of their own behavior. In contrast to that was sort of ordinary, what anybody could do, ego-supportive casework, where the you support the person in their current functioning without trying to change their personality. Heavy use of techniques of reassurance, advice, rational discussion, and no particular aim for self-understanding. So these were the two distinctions that were made certainly at this agency, but also throughout social work. And as I say, only experienced, highly skilled clinicians were supposed to be doing the ego-modifying, which was much more prestigious. The second concern they had was whether seeing people as individuals or a husband and wife as a couple was more effective. And this is a time when almost all treatment was individual. They had just instituted this new family, or not even family, husband and wife interventions, and they had a small project at that time that was looking at whether if you brought the husband into treatment, did that improve the efficacy of treatment. And then they said, since we're looking at everything else, let's look at this brand new short-term treatment that has just come into vogue. And at this point, they really just threw this in because they had no questions whatsoever that the long-term open-ended service was going to be more effective. So that was that contrast was between long-term, open-ended, no set time, date. And theoretically, it could go on indefinitely and indeed should go on for several years. For the project, they limited it to 18 months so that they could finish the project. And then they compared that to short-term time-limited treatment where a time limit was set at the very beginning of treatment. And in this case, they were using 8 sessions over 2 to 3 months as the time limit. This is not task-centered. But this is the beginning and where the ideas came from. So what happened? They took 4 years. They had 16 cases assigned to each of those bottom cells at the bottom. So they were able to compare the three different types of treatment, and they did that by, the three different pairs of treatment modalities, and they were able to do that by randomly assigning cases to those cells at the very bottom of that diagram. So what happened? Well, the first thing that happened, Hollis and after her read were very interested in the techniques and the process of psychodynamic casework. And they did a lot of research on trying to categorize the interventions that practitioners were using. So Hollis had developed a typology of interventions based on the ego-modifying, ego-supportive concepts. And they applied these. They tape-recorded the sessions, and they applied the coding schemas. And some of you, we were talking earlier about coding tapes, which we've all had experience with. But people listened to the tapes and said, okay, here the practitioner is using an insight-oriented technique, and here they're using reassurance and so on. They found that with this huge distinction, theoretically, between ego-modifying and ego-supportive, there was no difference in terms of what the practitioners were doing. Most of the intervention was what was called ego-supportive. Even in cases that were supposed to be ego-modifying, there was not a heavy use of insight-oriented techniques and these special techniques to change the relationship between the id and the ego and the superego. So that didn't work out. They couldn't use that comparison at all, because there was no difference between cases that were assigned to ego-modifying or ego-supportive. So they were left with trying to look at individual and joint, and people remember what happened with this? They couldn't get the husbands to come into treatment. So that, I've always thought that this was reminiscence of a time when it was a very female-dominated profession, that the female social workers couldn't get the husbands to come in. Husbands were more willing to come in when they used short-term treatment with a time limit, but still they were not able to make a distinction between the the individual and the family, the marital treatment, the dual treatment. So that comparison fell out altogether. And they were left with the comparison that was least interest to them, which was the planned short-term and the open-ended. And what happened is that they had 32 measures of outcome, and on 9 of those 32 measures, there was a significant difference, and people know what the significant difference was. It was in favor of short-term. So the problem outcome was better, the emotional distress of family members was better, emotional climate of the home was better, the spousal functioning, the husband's feelings about himself, the observers, and these measures included both client measures, practitioner measures, and outside observers who rated audio tapes. Except in one area, short-term treatment came out better as more effective than the open-ended long-term treatment. The biggest differences were at the lower levels of change. The long-term treatment was more likely to get worse or have no change at all, and the planned short-term treatment was likely to have some change. And very few people had a lot of change. But unequivocally from this study, they found that the short-term treatment was effective. And one of the things they did was then look at some of the reasons that it was effective. Reed came back to SSA and hooked up with Laura Epstein, and the two of them, and I don't know how they did this, but they came together and developed the treatment model, which became the task-centered model. And that model took from that brief and extended study that I just mentioned. First of all, the planned short-term time limits that seemed to be very important in the motivating people to actually continue in treatment and to work on their treatment. They took from that experiment, and again, these are things that they found by analyzing the tape recordings of people, that the short-term treatment had more of a emphasis on focal problems and not changing the personality over a long time. So it was the first time that an intervention in social work did not have as an ultimate goal changing the client's personality. Or I should say it's the first time since the psychodynamic year. The other thing they took from the short-term, long-term study was that the limited goals were directly related to problems. Instead of having major, huge goals of personality change, the goals were much more realistic and much more related to the problems that the person came in with. Some of the differences from that study were that the new practice model diagnosed around target problems and tasks, not around personality traits or personality functioning. The goals were more specific and limited, and there was more attention to the client conceptualization of problems and plans. I was talking earlier, and a colleague mentioned that one of the hallmarks was of their research, Reed and Epstein's research, was this emphasis on clients. What they thought, what they said, and what their perceptions were. So that was added there. And then pieces that they added included having a problem typology, different types of problems, an explicit worker-client agreement, which prior to this was not a normal part of treatment, and then specifications of how people were going to change the modes of treatment, which in this case was through action tasks that the client carries out in the environment. This new model, I mean, the research findings at that point did not show you how to do all of this, so they indeed relied very heavily on current theories. From Parrott and Rappaport, they used crisis theory, and that's Rappaport up in the upper left-hand corner. They used from Smalley functional casework, and that's her, where did she go? She's the top right-hand side. The use of time and the structure and focus. And I always find this ironic because you don't think of functional social workers coming into task-centered. But in fact, the deliberate use of time, using time to pressure people to actually motivate them to do things, and using a structure within that comes straight from functional. Very heavy emphasis on Helen Harris-Perlman's problem solving, and that's her in the bottom left-hand corner. And from Hollis, of course, the psychosocial basis of all of intervention, and including the methods of treatment and the verbal classification of interventions. So they didn't do this alone. There were a lot of people who worked with him. in the bottom right is Bill Reed, a doctoral student, and Elsie Pinkston, and I'm sorry, bottom left. Top right is Laura Epstein, Bill Reed, Ron Rooney, and Eleanor Tolson. And this kind of collaborative exchange was always going on. And the list of names I gave you earlier from Columbia, those people were talking all the time in terms of developing these models. Is everybody familiar with the task center model? I don't need to go through these characteristics. I'll talk only about ones that I haven't already briefly mentioned, but one of the value premises was that the client's wishes are paramount and that it's very... sorry. this is the second slide, that the action-oriented, it was probably, I guess the behaviorists were already working in the environment, but taking treatment out of the session into the environment that the client was in was a real innovation at that point through tasks. And then the practitioner's role was very new, and that was much more active than it was supposed to be in psychosocial treatment. Now, you remember I said, in fact, people were not doing ego-modifying casework. So, in fact, they weren't doing I want to call it laid back, but that's not a term they ever would have used then. They were not doing the kind of, I don't want to say passive, that's not the right word. Anyway, they were, in fact, being active, giving client suggestions and so on. And one of the things that they followed up on, Reed and Epstein, is the use of advice as a catalyst for people's ideas about what to do. And they found, this is later, they found that when practitioners gave advice, the clients didn't follow it, but it stimulated, I mean, sometimes they followed it, but it stimulated better ideas for them. So that it wasn't telling them what to do, but it was giving them a beginning, a set of ideas about how to do it. And then the final thing that was critically important in this model was the empirical orientation, which includes using data, using very low level of inference. Those personality inferences were not part of the model, and continued development of the model. Now, is that readable at all? this is essentially a timeline of task-centered practice. The first book came out in 1972 was task-centered casework, and then a couple years later, Reed and Epstein edited task-centered practice, and that was the first essentially dissemination of the model. There were a lot of people in this room actually worked on materials that were incorporated in that. It had 17 contributors from mostly from the United States but also from England talking about the use of task-centered. So that was the first step in the dissemination. In the late 1970s, it really became people started using it in Britain. And really, by the mid-80s, there were many publications from Britain and the Netherlands. And as I'm going to show you, it ends up that in those two countries, task-centered has become the basis of social services in the countries. In the mid-80s, people were extending, other people were starting to write books as well, as articles, and extending task-centered practice to not just individual modalities, but also to other things. There was an edited book on families and groups. Ron Rooney started writing about work with involuntary clients. Parihar started talking about using task-centered methods for social administration. And so on. So there started to be a tremendous attempt to generalize this to other areas. And I want to say, one of the premises that certainly Reed had in his research was that there were processes that were applicable to many clients, most clients, and that part of the researcher's job was to find out what processes those were. And that's in contrast to what is currently funded, which tends to be very problem-specific interventions without an assumption that they're generalizable to other problems and other people. So you get that with a culturally competent movement and with much of the federal funding for very specific problems. But the intent of all of this was to really try to find those find those processes and try to generalize them to new situations. The last piece I want to mention, you can't probably read it, but the very last book was published last year, and it's a history of the of social work in the Netherlands. And the title of it, when you translate it from the Dutch, is From Mary Richmond to William Reed. Just as an example of the influence that task center practice had in the Netherlands. Again, some of the people that they were working with, the top right, the top left, is a group that were in the Netherlands, Nell Jacht, Cynthia Bailey Dempsey, Lou Jacht, I think I got them backwards, whoops, there, and Bill Reed. And then on the bottom right, is Judy Nelson, Susan Stern, Eleanor Tolson, and one of Reed's colleagues. And those people, just coincidentally, were very involved with family systems work and influenced Reed and Epstein in incorporating some of the family systems into this. If I've got time, I wanted to just show you a little bit of a development of how this worked. One of the things that they did was what they call D&D, design and development kind of research, which is a very eclectic, very small step building through research to find out what works, what doesn't work, and what happens. One of the key parts of task center practice is the task implementation sequence. And I thought I might take you through some of the research on developing that and trying to make that an effective intervention. The first set of studies was three small studies that used 32 cases. They were all over in the hospital at Billings that were looking to see whether this new task-centered model could be used, I mean, whether it worked at all. Because remember, they made this up at this point. They drew on the research findings, but nobody had tried it out before. And basically, they found yes, it did work, but they needed a lot more attention to the tasks and a lot more attention to what the practitioner was doing. So they then started a test of the task implementation sequence. And the task implementation sequence is once you have problems and goals that you're trying to achieve, then you use tasks in the environment to do that and to enhance the likelihood that the client is going to do the task. There's a set of interventions that include enhancing commitment, planning task implementation, analyzing the obstacles that might prevent somebody from carrying out the task, modeling or rehearsing or practicing how to do it, and then summarizing everything so the client remembers. And this is used now not only when you first develop a task, but if a task fails, this sequence is used. And it's probably the biggest difference between solution focused intervention is that they don't have a way of dealing with it if their tasks or their assignments fail. But from the very beginning, Reed and Epstein were trying to look at, you know, what might be the obstacles and how would you deal with them. So they had a study that was took 2 years included the student practitioners in the task-centered sequence here at SSA, and they went through the problem setting and goal setting and contracting phases, developed the task, and then they were randomly assigned. Each student had two cases. They were randomly assigned to either do the task implementation sequence or not do it. And not surprisingly, the cases in which they did do the task implementation sequence, they had better outcome on the tasks than when they didn't do task implementation sequence. But that one task did not have an impact on ultimate outcome. They were the same, pretty much. One of the criticisms of this study I just talked about is that they were spending a lot more time doing the task implementation sequence than they were spending time with the other tasks. So one of the criticisms is that it could be simply the amount of time and not the task implementation sequence that made a difference. So in the next study, they took, again, a set of 44 SSA students, each of whom had two cases, and once the problems and goals were formulated, they randomly assigned the cases to get either 3 weeks of task-centered interventions, the task implementation sequence, review of tasks the next week, and then a new task implementation. 3 weeks of that, and the other people received only supportive attention. So it was the same amount of time, but not the formal structure of the task implementation sequence. They again found that the task-centered people did better in the task accomplishment, but also in target problem change. So when they did it in a more intensive way over 3 weeks, it did have an impact on outcome. The next study, labeled D, was looking at the task-centered stuff, the task implementation sequence and problem review together. They, again, 20 cases with students, and in this they found that the more the students used the task-centered implementation sequence, the more change there was in target problems. So that was just a descriptive study where they didn't manipulate anything, but they did find that the more you use the task-centered pieces, the better the outcome. The next study, they took 30 families, and the previous cases were all individuals, and these were actually families, and developed, and this was really Reed's conceptualization, and he was really trying to get family systems into there, but they developed the idea that there was a joint intervention which was in the session, they prepared the task, and then actually practiced it. They did it in the session. And then the family was supposed to take it home and do it. So if it was a marital case, they might, where the husband and wife were arguing over finances, they might practice in the session how to talk about finances without arguing, and then their task for the week would be to go home and have a discussion about certain financial issues without arguing. So it was a linkage of doing the practice in the session with the doing it in out of the session. And again, they found that the people who used that now called family task implementation sequence managed better than those who did not. Two more studies that did it. I'm not going to go into them, but they were similar kinds of studies. Now, this started in sometime in the early 70s, and went through the late 80s and early 90s as a series of experiments. And I'm just trying to demonstrate how Reed did the D&D, the development, using small-scale studies and relatively cheap resources to test various aspects of the intervention and to get it done. It ended with two books that were not didn't include original research. One of them was Task Strategies, where it was an attempt to go beyond these individual tasks and try to put them together in overall strategies for how you might deal with a particular type of problem. So he's trying to generalize from the individual task to the how do you approach a problem, what kinds of tasks. You know, they might include 10 tasks that were incrementally building toward a goal. And then the second book, Task Planner, where he published a very large number of these task strategies with assessment of how effective they might be, but for specific problems. So he was now looking at specific problems and how do you resolve them. I forgot that slide, but those were the two books. The Task Planner is still available, and it has a CD-ROM. So if you have a aging parent with an alcohol problem, you can search it for adults, older adults with alcohol problems, and find out possible strategies. They are, to the extent it was possible, the strategies are based in research that others have done. They're not straight out of Reed's research and Epstein's research. But so that was how he was trying to pull things together. In conclusion, I just want to say that what they did was, what I just outlined was only a piece of the ongoing research. That was a systematic set of research looking at the task implementation sequence. And there were other areas in which they were doing other research, looking at clients' agreement to do things, how important was that, looking at the effect of advice as a catalyst, whole range of other things that were also being looked at. But that was one example. So what they managed to do was to develop this model that was really social work's first empirically based practice model. It's now the basis of social services in at least three countries. It's used in 11 countries. There's over 200 publications that are in 9 languages that I know of. There are probably more than that. And it's generally used either as a standalone or as part of a larger intervention package. For example, in Switzerland, it's now used as a action part of a large wraparound support service for people who are experiencing problems. And then a quote we've already heard, this comes from the most recent edition of the Encyclopedia of Social Work, where the author was saying task-centered has not been particularly dynamic recently, which I will disagree with, but he concluded by saying many of the central principles of task-centered practice are now considered simply good social work practice. And I contrast that to the beginning where all of this was absolutely unheard of and not considered anything reasonable to be doing. Thank you. Questions? Yes, sorry. Thank you.
I believe you mentioned in the beginning that there was one aspect of long-term treatment that showed some better results than short-term treatment. Do you know what that might be?
It had to do with the... I'm sorry, I don't remember. I'm sorry.
Maybe later we can.
What?
Maybe later we could.
Yeah, I can find
that
it.
Out. That'd be great. Thank you.
We have time for one more question.
Since it's me, of course, it's not a question, it's a comment.
Everybody recognizes Elsie Pinkston.
I just
who was a major influence on Reed and Epstein.
Well, and I have delightful stories to tell. But one of the things I think we should recognize is context in which these things can develop. And Harold Richman and John Sherman were just there with all the support that they could provide, task-centered, behavioral, and various other new people who came in to try and record data. And I just want to be sure we all understood that, so Jean will know she'll be appreciated later. So.
I think that's a
group.
I think that's a critical point, that the deans, not just at SSA, but at the other two schools that became centers of evidence-based practice, really, at the time, went out on a limb to try to improve social work practice. A lot of credit is due to them. Jean?